We want information. You won't get it. It was hard to sound as tough as Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner when you still felt like crying, but I did my best. Even if I asked, pretty please? She took my hand, slipped it inside her sweater, placed it on her left breast. The part of me which had begun to swoon snapped immediately back to attention. Well, have you ever done it before? I mean, all the way? That's the information I want. I hesitated. It's a question most boys find difficult, I imagine, and one most lie about. I didn't want to lie to Carol. No, I said. She slipped daintily out of her panties, tossed them over into the back seat, and laced her fingers together behind my neck. I have, twice, with Sully. I don't think he was very good at it, but he'd never been to college. You have. My mouth felt very dry, but that must have been an illusion, because when I kissed her, our mouths were wet. They slipped all around, tongues and lips and nipping teeth. When I could talk, I said, I'll do my best to share my college education. Put on the radio, she said, unbuckling my belt and unsnapping my jeans. Put on the radio, Pete. I like the oldies. So I put on the radio and I kissed her, and there was a spot, a certain spot. Her fingers guided me to it, and there was a moment when I was the same old, and then there was a new place to be. She was very warm in there, very warm and very tight. She whispered in my ear, her lips tickling against the skin, slow, eat every one of your vegetables, and maybe you'll get dessert. Jackie Wilson sang Lonely Teardrops, and I went slow. Roy Orbison sang Only the Lonely, and I went slow. Wanda Jackson sang Let's Have a Party, and I went slow. Mighty John did an ad for Brannigan's, Derry's hottest bottle club, and I went slow. Then she began to moan, and it wasn't her fingers on my neck, but her nails digging into it. And when she began to move her hips up against me in short, hard thrusts, I couldn't go slow. And then the Platters were on the radio. The Platters were singing Twilight Time, and she began to moan that she hadn't known, hadn't a clue. Oh, gee, oh, Pete, oh, gee, oh, Jesus, Jesus Christ, Pete. And her lips were all over my mouth and my chin and my jaw. She was frantic with kisses. I could hear the seat creaking. I could smell cigarette smoke and the pine air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror. And by then I was moaning too. I don't know what. The Platters were singing, Each Day I Pray for Evening Just to Be with You. And then it started to happen. The pump turns on in ecstasy. I closed my eyes. I held her with my eyes closed and went into her that way you do, shaking all over, hearing the heel of my shoe drumming against the driver's side door in a spastic tattoo, thinking that I could do this even if I was dying, even if I was dying, even if I was dying, thinking also that it was information. The pump turns on in ecstasy. The cards fall where they fall. The world never misses a beat. The queen hides. The queen is found. And it was all information. The next morning, I had a brief meeting with my geology instructor, who told me I was edging into a grave situation. That is not exactly new information, number six, I thought of telling him, but didn't. The world looked different this morning, both better and worse. When I got back to Chamberlain, I found Nate getting ready to leave for home. He had his suitcase in one hand. There was a sticker on it that said, I climbed Mount Washington. Slung over his shoulder was a duffel full of dirty clothes. Like everything else, Nate looked different now. Have a good Thanksgiving, Nate, I said, opening my closet and starting to yank out pants and shirts at random. Eat lots of stuffing. You're too fucking skinny. I will. Cranberry dressing, too. When I was at my most homesick that first week, my mom's dressing was practically all I could think about. I filled my own suitcase, thinking that I could take Carol to the bus depot in Derry and then just keep on going. If the traffic on Route 136 wasn't too heavy, I could be home before dark. Maybe even stop in Frank's Fountain for a mug of root beer before heading up Sebattis Road to the house. Suddenly being out of this place, away from Chamberlain Hall and Holyoke Commons, away from the whole damned university, was my number one priority. "You're confused, Pete," Carol had said in the car last night. "You don't know what you want or what you think, and you won't as long as you keep running those cards." Well, this was my chance to get away from the cards. It hurt to know Carol was leaving, but I'd be lying if I said that was foremost in my mind right then. At that moment, getting away from the third-floor lounge was getting away from the bitch. If you flunk out this December, you're apt to be in the jungle next December. "Be in touch, baby. See ya," as Skip Kirk usually put it. When I latched the suitcase shut and looked around, Nate was still standing in the doorway. I jumped and let out a little squeak of surprise. It was like being visited by Banquo's fucking ghost. "Hey, go on. Bug out," I said. "Time and tide wait for no man, not even one in pre-dent." Nate only stood there, looking at me. "You're going to flunk out," he said. Again I thought of how weirdly alike Nate and Carol were, almost male and female sides of the same coin. I tried to smile, but Nate didn't smile back. His face was small and white and pinched, the perfect Yankee face. You see a skinny guy who always burns instead of tanning, whose idea of dressing up includes a string tie and a liberal application of Vitalis, a guy who looks like he hasn't had a decent shit in 3 years, and that guy was most likely born and raised north of White River, New Hampshire. And on his deathbed, his last words are apt to be, "Cranberry dressing." "Nah," I said. "Don't sweat it, Nady. All's cool." "You're going to flunk out," he repeated. Dull, bricky color was rising in his cheeks. "You and Skip are the best guys I know. There wasn't anybody in high school like you guys, not in my high school at least, and you're going to flunk out and it's so stupid." "I'm not going to flunk out," I said. But since last night, I had found myself accepting the idea that I could. I wasn't just edging into a grave situation. Man, I was there. "Skip either. It's under control. The world's falling down and you two are flunking out of school over hearts, over a stupid fucking card game." Before I could say anything else, he was gone, headed back up the county for turkey and his mom's stuffing. Maybe even a through-the-pants hand job from Cindy. Hey, why not? It was Thanksgiving. I don't read my horoscope, have rarely watched The X-Files, have never called the Psychic Friends hotline, but I nevertheless believe that we all get glimpses of the future from time to time. I got one that afternoon when I pulled up in front of Franklin Hall in my brother's old station wagon. She was already gone. I went inside. The lobby, where there were usually 8 or 9 gentlemen callers sitting in the plastic chairs, looked oddly empty. A housekeeper in a blue uniform was vacuuming the industrial-strength rug. The girl behind the counter was reading a copy of McCall's and listening to the radio. Question mark in the Mysterians, as a matter of fact. Cry, 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 baby. 96 tears. "Pete Riley for Carol Gerber," I said. "Can you buzz her?" She looked up, put her magazine aside, and gave me a sweet, sympathetic look. It was the look of a doctor who has to tell you, "Gee, sorry, the tumor's inoperable. Bad luck, man. Better make friends with Jesus." "Carol said she had to leave early. She took the Black Bear shuttle to Derry. But she told me you'd be by and asked me to give you this." She handed me an envelope with my name written across the front. I thanked her and left Franklin with it in my hand. I went down the walk and stood for a moment by my car, looking across toward Holyoke Commons, fabled palace on the plains and home of the horny hot dog man. Below it, in Bennett's Run, leaves flew before the wind in rattling drifts. The bright colors had gone out of them. Only November's dark brown was left. It was the day before Thanksgiving, the doorstep of winter in New England. The world was all wind and cold sunshine. I had started crying again. I could tell by the warmth on my cheeks. 96 tears, baby. Cry, cry, cry. I got into the car, where I had lost my virginity the night before, and opened the envelope. There was a single sheet of paper inside. Brevity is the soul of wit, according to Shakespeare. If it's true, then Carol's letter was witty as hell. Dear Pete, I think we ought to let last night be our goodbye. How could we do any better? I may write to you at school or I may not. Right now I'm so confused I just don't know. Hey, I may even change my mind and come back. But please, let me be the one to get in touch, okay? You said you loved me. If you do, let me be the one to get in touch. I will. I promise. Carol. P.S. Last night was the sweetest thing that's ever happened to me. If it gets any better than that, I don't see how people can live through it. P.P.S. Get out of that stupid card game. She said it was the sweetest thing that had ever happened to her, but she hadn't put love at the bottom of the note, only her signature. Still, if it gets any better than that, I don't see how people can live through it. I knew what she meant. I reached over and touched the side of the seat where she had lain, where we had lain together. Put on the radio, Pete. I like the oldies. I looked at my watch. I had gotten to the dorm early, that half-conscious premonition at work, maybe, and it had just gone 3 now. I could easily get to the Trailways Depot before she left for Connecticut, but I wasn't going to do it. She was right. We had said a brilliant goodbye in my old station wagon. Anything more would be a step down. At best, we would find ourselves going over the same ground. At worst, we'd splash mud over last night with an argument. We want information. Yes, and we had gotten it. God knew we had. I folded her letter, stuck it into the back pocket of my jeans, and drove home to Gates Falls. At first, my eyes kept blurring, and I had to keep wiping at them. Then I turned on the radio, and the music made things a little better. The music always does. I'm past 50 now, and the music still makes things better. It's the fabled automatic. I got back to Gates around 5:30, slowed as I drove past Frank's, then kept on going. By then, I wanted to get home a lot more than I wanted to draft hires and a gossip with Frank Parmelo. Mom's way of saying welcome home was to tell me I was too skinny, my hair was too long, and I hadn't been standing close enough to the razor. Then she sat in her rocking chair and had a little weep over the return of the prodigal son. My dad put a kiss on my cheek, hugged me with one arm, and then shuffled to the fridge for a glass of Mom's red tea, his head poking forward out of the neck of his old brown sweater like the head of a curious turtle. We, my mom and me, that is, thought he had 20% of his eyesight left, maybe a bit more. It was hard to tell because he so rarely talked. It was a bagging room accident that did for him, a terrible 2-story fall. He had scars on the left side of his face and his neck. There was a dented-in patch of skull where the hair never grew back. The accident pretty much blacked out his vision, and it did something to his mind as well. But he was not a total idiot, as I once heard some asshole down at Gendron's barbershop say, nor was he mute, as some people seemed to think. He was in a coma for 19 days. After he woke up, he became mostly silent, that much is true, and he was often terribly confused in his mind, but sometimes he was still there, all present, and accounted for. He was there enough when I came home to give me a kiss and that strong one-armed hug, his way of hugging for as long as I could remember. I loved my old man a lot, and after a semester of playing cards with Ronnie Malenfant, I had learned that talking is a wildly overrated skill. I sat with them for a while, telling them some of my college stories, not about chasing the bitch, though, then went outside. I raked fallen leaves in the twilight. The frosty air on my cheeks was like a blessing, waved at the passing neighbors, and ate 3 of my mom's hamburgers for supper. After, she told me she was going down to the church, where the ladies' aide was preparing Thanksgiving meals for shut-ins. She didn't think I'd want to spend my first evening home with a bunch of old hens, but I was welcome to attend the Cluckfest if I wanted. I thanked her and said I thought I'd give Anne-Marie a call instead. "Now, why doesn't that surprise me?" she said, and went out. I heard the car start, and then, with no great joy, I dragged myself to the telephone and called Anne-Marie Soucy. An hour later, she drove over in her father's pickup, smiling, her hair down on her shoulders, mouth radiant with lipstick. The smile didn't last long, as I guess you can probably figure out for yourself, and 15 minutes after she came in, Anne-Marie was out of the house and out of my life. "Be in touch, baby. See ya." Right around the time of Woodstock, she married an insurance man from Lewiston and became Anne-Marie Gelbert. They had 3 kids, and they're still married. I guess that's good, isn't it? Even if it isn't, you have to admit it's pretty goddamn American. I stood at the window over the kitchen sink, watching the taillights of Mr. Soucy's truck disappear down the road. I felt ashamed of myself. Christ, the way her eyes had widened, the way her smile had faded and begun to tremble. But I also felt shittily happy, disgustingly relieved, light enough to dance up the walls and across the ceiling like Fred Astaire. There were shuffling steps from behind me. I turned, and there was my dad, doing his slow turtle walk across the linoleum in his slippers. He went with one hand held out before him. The skin on it was beginning to look like a big, loose glove.
Did I just hear a young lady call a young gentleman a fucking jerk? He asked in a mild, just passing the time voice. Well, yeah, I shuffled my feet. I guess maybe you did.
He opened the fridge, groped, and brought out the jug of red tea. He drank it without sugar. I have taken it that same way on occasion and can tell you it tastes like almost nothing at all. My theory is that my dad always went for the red tea because it was the brightest thing in the icebox, and he always knew what it was.
Soucy girl, wasn't it?
Yeah, Dad, Anne-Marie.
All them Soucies have the distemper, Pete. Slammed the door, didn't she?
I was smiling. I couldn't help it. It was a wonder the glass was still in that poor old door.
I guess she did. You trade her in for a newer model up there at the college, did you?
That was a fairly complicated question. The simple answer, and maybe the truest in the end, was no, I hadn't. That was the answer I gave. He nodded, set out the biggest glass in the cabinet next to the fridge, and then looked like he was getting ready to pour the tea all over the counter and his own feet anyway.
Let me do that for you, I said. Okay?
He made no reply, but stood back and let me pour the tea. I put the 3/4 full glass into his hands and the jug back into the fridge.
Is it good, Dad?
Nothing. He only stood there with the glass in both hands, the way a child holds a glass, drinking in little sips. I waited, decided he wasn't going to reply, and fetched my suitcase out of the corner. I'd thrown my textbooks in on top of my clothes, and now took them out.
"Studying on the first night of break," Dad said, startling me. I'd almost forgot he was there. "Gorry."
"Well, I'm a little behind in a couple of classes. The teachers move a lot faster than the ones in high school."
"College," he said. A long pause. "You're in college."
It seemed almost to be a question, so I said, "That's right, Dad." He stood there a while longer, seeming to watch me as I stacked my books and notebooks. Maybe he was watching. Or maybe he was just standing there. You couldn't tell, not for sure. At last he began to shuffle toward the door, neck stretched out, that defensive hand slightly raised, his other hand, the one with the glass of red tea in it, now curled against his chest. At the door he stopped. Without looking around he said,
"You're well shut of that Soucy girl. All Soucies has got bad tempers. You can dress 'em up, but you can't take 'em out." You can do better."
He went out, holding his glass of tea curled to his chest. Until my brother and his wife showed up from New Gloucester, I actually did study, half caught up on my sociology and slogged through 40 pages of geology, all in 3 brain-busting hours. By the time I stopped to make coffee, I'd begun to feel faint stirrings of hope. I was behind, disastrously behind, but maybe not quite fatally behind. I felt like an outfielder who has tracked a ball back and back to the left field wall. He stands there looking up but not giving up, knowing that the ball's going to carry over, but also knowing that if he times his leap just right, he can catch it as it does. I could do that. If that was, I could stay out of the third floor lounge in the future. At 10:15, my brother, who arrives nowhere while the sun is still up, if he can help it, drove in. His wife of 8 months, glamorous in a coat with a real mink collar, was carrying a bread pudding. Dave had a bowl of butter beans. Only my brother, of all people on earth, would think of transporting butter beans across county lines for Thanksgiving purposes. "He's a good guy, Dave, my elder by 6 years, and in 1966, an accountant for a small hamburger chain with 6 shops in Maine and New Hampshire. By 1996, there were 80 shops, and my brother, along with 3 partners, owned the company. He's worth $3 million, on paper at least, and has had a triple bypass. 1 bypass for each million, I guess you could say." Hard on Dave and Katie's heels came Mom from the Ladies' Aid, dusted with flour, exhilarated from good works, and overjoyed to have both of her sons in the house. There was a lot of cheerful babble. Our dad sat in the corner listening to it without adding anything. But he was smiling, his odd, big-pupiled eyes going from Dave's face to mine and then back to Dave's. It was actually our voices his eyes were responding to, I suppose. Dave wanted to know where Anne-Marie was. I said Anne-Marie and I had decided to cool it for a while. Dave started to ask if that meant we were... Before he could finish the question, both his mother and his wife gave him those sharp little female pokes that meant, "Not now, buddy, not now." Looking at Mom's wide eyes, I guessed she would have her own questions for me later on, probably quite a few of them. Mom wanted information. Moms always do. Other than being called a fucking jerk by Anne-Marie and wondering from time to time how Carol Gerber was doing, mostly if she'd changed her mind about coming back to school and if she was sharing her Thanksgiving with old army-bound Sully John, that was a pretty great holiday. The whole family showed up at one time or another on Thursday or Friday, it seemed, wandering through the house and gnawing on turkey legs, watching football games on TV and roaring at the big plays, chopping wood for the kitchen stove. By Sunday night, Mom had enough stove lengths to heat the house all winter with just the Franklin if she'd wanted. After supper, we ate pie and played Scrabble. Most entertaining of all, Dave and Katie had a huge fight over the house they were planning to buy, and Katie hucked a Tupperware dish of leftovers at my brother. I had taken a few lumps at Dave's hands over the years, and I liked watching that plastic container of squash bounce off the side of his head. Man, that was fun. But underneath all the good stuff, the ordinary joy you feel when your whole family's there, was my fear of what was going to happen when I went back to school. I found an hour to study late Thursday night, after the fridge had been stuffed full of leftovers and everyone else had gone to bed, and 2 more hours on Friday afternoon when there was a lull in the flow of relatives, and Dave and Katie, their differences temporarily resolved, retired for what I thought was an extremely noisy nap. I still felt I could catch up, knew it, actually, but I also knew I couldn't do it alone or with Nate. I had to buddy up with someone who understood the suicidal pull of that third-floor lounge and how the blood surged when someone started playing spades in an effort to force the bitch. Someone who understood the primitive joy of managing to sock Ronnie with La Femme Noire. It would have to be Skip, I thought. Even if Carol were to come back, she would never be able to understand in the same way. It had to be Skip and me, swimming out of deep water and in toward the shore. I thought if we stuck together, we could both pull through.
Not that I cared so much about him. Admitting that feels scuzzy, but it's the truth. By Saturday of Thanksgiving break, I'd done lots of soul-searching and understood I was mostly concerned about myself, mostly looking out for number six. If Skip wanted to use me, that was fine, because I sure wanted to use him. By noon Saturday, I'd read enough geology to know I needed help on some of the concepts, and fast. There were only two more big test periods in the semester, a set of prelims and then final exams. I would have to do really well on both to keep my scholarships. Dave and Katie left at around 7 on Saturday night, still bickering, but more good-naturedly, about the house they planned to buy in Pownal. I settled down at the kitchen table and started reading about out-group sanctions in my soch book. What it seemed to amount to was even nerds have to have someone to shit on, a depressing concept. At some point, I became aware I wasn't alone. I looked up and saw my mother standing there in her old pink housecoat, her face ghostly with Pond's cold cream. I wasn't surprised that I hadn't heard her. After 25 years in the same little house, she knew where all the creaks and groans were. I thought she had finally gotten around to her questions about Anne-Marie, but it turned out that my love life was the last thing on her mind. "How much trouble are you in, Peter?" she asked. I thought of about 100 different answers and then settled for the truth. "I don't really know." "Is it any one thing in particular?" This time I didn't tell the truth, and looking back on it, I realize how telling that lie was. Some part of me, alien to my best interests but very powerful, still reserved the right to frog march me to the cliff and over the edge. "Yeah, Mom, the third floor lounge is the problem. Cards are the problem. Just a few hands is what I tell myself every time, and when I look up at the clock, it's 12:15 and I'm too tired to study. Hell, too wired to study. Other than play hearts, all I've really managed to do this fall is lose my virginity." If I could have said at least the first part of that, I think it would have been like guessing Rumpelstiltskin's name and then speaking it out loud. But I didn't say any of it. I told her it was just the pace of college. I had to redefine what studying meant, learn some new habits. But I could do it. I was sure I could. She stood there a moment longer, her arms crossed and her hands deep in her housecoat sleeves. She looked sort of like a Chinese mandarin when she stood that way. And then she said, "I'll always love you, Pete. Your father, too. He doesn't say it, but he feels it. We both do. You know that." "Yeah," I said, "I know that." I got up and hugged her. Pancreatic cancer was what got her. That one's quick at least, but it wasn't quick enough. I guess none of them are when it's someone you love. "But you have to work hard at your studies. Boys who don't work hard at them have been dying." She smiled. There wasn't much humor in it. "Probably you knew that. I heard a rumor." "You're still growing," she said, tilting her head up. "I don't think so." "Yes, at least an inch since summer. And your hair. Why don't you cut your hair?" "I like it the way it is." "It's as long as a girl's. Take my advice, Pete. Cut your hair. Look decent. You're not one of those Rolling Stones or Harmon's Hermit, after all." I burst out laughing. I couldn't help it. "I'll think about it, Mom. Okay?" "You do that." She gave me another hard hug, then let me go. She looked tired, but I thought she also looked rather beautiful. "They're killing boys across the sea," she said. "At first, I thought there was a good reason for it. But your father says it's crazy, and I'm not so sure he isn't right. You study hard. If you need a little extra for books, or a tutor, we'll scrape it up." "Thanks, Mom. You're a peach." "Nope," she said. "Just an old mare with tired feet. I'm going to bed." I studied another hour. Then all the words started to double and triple in front of my eyes. I went to bed myself, but couldn't sleep. Every time I started to drift, I saw myself picking up a heart's hand and beginning to arrange it in suits. Finally, I let my eyes roll open and just stared up at the ceiling. "Boys who don't work hard at their studies have been dying," my mother had said. And Carol telling me this was a good time to be a girl. Lyndon Johnson had seen to that.
We chasing the bitch.
Pass left or right.
Jesus Christ, fucking Riley shooting the moon.
Voices in my head. Voices seeming to seep out of the very air. Quitting the game was the only sane solution to my problems, but even with the third-floor lounge 130 miles north of where I was lying, it had a hold on me, one which had little to do with sanity or rationality. I'd amassed 12 points in the Uber tourney. Only Ronnie, with 15, was now ahead of me. I didn't see how I could give those 12 points up, just walk away and leave that windbag Malenfant with a clear field. Carol had helped me keep Ronnie in some sort of perspective, allowed me to see him for the creepy, small-minded, bad-complexioned gnome that he was. Now that she was gone... Ronnie's also going to be gone before long, the voice of reason interposed. If he lasts to the end of the semester, it'll be a blue-eyed miracle. You know that. True. And in the meantime, Ronnie had nothing else but hearts, did he? He was clumsy, pot-bellied, and thin-armed, an old man waiting to happen. He wore a chip on his shoulder to at least partially hide his massive feelings of inferiority. His boasting about girls was ludicrous. Also, he wasn't really smart, like some of the kids currently in danger of flunking out, Skip Kirk, for instance. Hearts and empty brag were the only things Ronnie was good at, so far as I'd been able to tell, so why not just stand back and let him run the cards and run his mouth while he still could? Because I didn't want to, that was why. Because I wanted to wipe the smirk off his hollow, pimply face and silence his grating blare of a laugh. It was mean, but it was true. I liked Ronnie best when he was sulking. When he was glowering at me with his greasy hair tumbled down over his forehead and his lower lip pushed out. Also, there was the game itself. I loved playing. I couldn't even stop thinking about it here, in my childhood bed. So how was I supposed to stay away from the lounge when I got back? How was I supposed to ignore Mark St. Pierre yelling at me to hurry up? There was a seat empty. Everyone stood at zero on the score pad and the game was about to commence. Christ! I was still awake when the cuckoo clock in the parlor below me sang 2 o'clock. I got up, threw on my old tartan robe over my skivvies, and went downstairs. I got myself a glass of milk and sat at the kitchen table to drink it. There were no lights on except for the fluorescent bar over the stove, no sounds except for the sough of the furnace through the floor grates and my father's soft snores from the back bedroom. I felt a little nutso, as if the combination of turkey and cramming had set off a minor earthquake in my head, and I felt as if I might next fall asleep around, oh, say, St. Patrick's Day. I happened to glance into the entry. There, hung on one of the hooks above the wood box, was my high school jacket, the one with the big white GF entwined on the breast. Nothing else but the initials. I hadn't been much of a jock. When Skip asked me, shortly after we met at the university, if I'd lettered in anything, I told him I had the big M for masturbation, first team, the short overhand stroke, my specialty. Skip had laughed until he cried, and maybe that was when we'd started being friends. Actually, I guess I could have gotten a D for debate or dramatics, but they don't give letters in those things, do they? Not then and not now. High school seemed far in the past to me on that night. Almost in another planetary system. But there was the jacket, a birthday present from my folks the year I turned 16. I crossed to the entry and took it off the hook. I put it up to my face and smelled it and thought of Period 5 study hall with Mr. Mazensik, the bitter aroma of pencil shavings, the girls whispering and giggling under their breath, faint shouts from outside as the phys ed kids played what the jocks called remedial volleyball. I saw that the place where the jacket had hung on the hook continued to stick up in a kind of dimple. The damn thing probably hadn't been worn, even by my mother, to go out and grab the mail in her nightgown since the previous April or May. I thought of seeing Carol frozen in newsprint dots, her face shadowed by a sign reading, U.S. out of Vietnam now,
her ponytail lying against the collar of her own high school jacket, and I had an idea. Our telephone, a Bakelite dinosaur with a rotary dial, was on a table in the front hall. In the drawer beneath it was the Gates Falls phone book, my mom's address book, and a litter of writing implements. One was a black laundry marker. I took it back to the kitchen table and sat down again. I spread my high school jacket over my knees, then used the marker to make a large sparrow track on the back. As I worked, I felt the nervous tension draining out of my muscles. It occurred to me that I could award myself my own letter if I wanted, and that was sort of what I was doing. When I was done, I held the jacket up and took a look. In the faint white light of the fluorescent bar, the peace sign I'd drawn looked harsh and declamatory and somehow childish. But I liked it. I liked that motherfucker. I wasn't sure what I thought about the war even then, but I liked that sparrow track quite a lot. And I felt as if I could finally go to sleep. Drawing it had done that much for me anyway. I rinsed out my milk glass and went upstairs with my jacket under my arm. I stuck it in the closet and then lay down. I thought of Carol putting my hand inside her sweater and the taste of her breath in my mouth. I thought of how we had been only ourselves behind the fogged up windows of my old station wagon, maybe our best selves. And I thought of how we had laughed as we stood watching the tatters of my Goldwater sticker blow away across the steam plant parking lot. I was thinking about that when I fell asleep. I took my modified high school jacket back to school on Sunday, packed into my suitcase. Despite her freshly voiced doubts about Mr. Johnson's and Mr. McNamara's war, my mom would have had lots of questions about the sparrow track, and I didn't have answers to give, not yet. I felt equipped to wear the jacket, though, and I did. I spilled beer and cigarette ashes on it, puked on it, bled on it, got tear gassed in Chicago while wearing it and screaming, "The whole world is watching," at the top of my lungs. Girls cried on the entwined GF on the left breast. By my senior year, those letters were dingy gray instead of white. And one girl lay on it while we made love. We did it with no protection, so probably there's a trace of semen on the quilting lining, too. By the time I packed up and left LSD Acres in 1970, the peace sign I drew on the back in my mother's kitchen was only a shadow, but the shadow remained. Others might not see it, but I always knew what it was. Came back to school on the Sunday after Thanksgiving in this order. Skip at 5, he lived in Dexter, the closest of the three of us, me at 7, Nate at around 9. I called Franklin Hall even before I unpacked my suitcase. No, the girl on the desk said, Carol Gerber wasn't back. She was plainly reluctant to say more, but I badgered her. There were two pink left school cards on the desk, she said. One of them had Carol's name and room number on it. I thanked her and hung up. I stood there a minute, fogging up the booth with my cigarette smoke, then turned around. Across the hall, I could see Skip sitting at one of the card tables, just picking up a spilled trick. I sometimes wonder if things might have been different if Carol had come back, or even if I'd beaten Skip back. Had a chance to get to him before the third-floor lounge got to him. I didn't, though. I stood there in the phone booth, smoking a Pall Mall and feeling sorry for myself. Then, from across the way, someone screamed, "Oh, shit, no, I don't fucking believe it!" To which Ronnie Malenfant, from where I stood in the phone booth, he was out of my view, but his voice was as unmistakable as the sound of a saw ripping through a knot in a pine branch, hollered gleefully back, "Whoa, look at this! Randy Eccles takes the first bitch of the post-Thanksgiving era!"
Don't go in there, I told myself. You are absolutely fucked if you do, fucked once and for all. But of course I did. The tables were all taken, but there were three other guys, Billy Marchant, Tony DeLuca, and Hugh Brennan, standing around. We could snag a corner if we so chose. Skip looked up from his hand and shot me a high five in the smoky air. Welcome back to the loony bin, Pete.
Hey, Ronnie said, looking around. Look who's here, the only asshole in the place who can almost play the game. Where you been, Chuckles?
Lewiston, I said, fucking your grandmother. Ronnie cackled, his pimply cheeks turning red. Skip was looking at me seriously, and maybe there was something in his eyes. I can't say for sure. Time goes by, Atlantis sinks deeper and deeper into the ocean, and you have a tendency to romanticize, to mythologize. Maybe I saw that he had given up, that he intended to stay here and play cards and then go on to whatever was next. Maybe he was giving me permission to go in my own direction. But I was 18, and more like Nate in many ways than I like to admit. I had also never had a friend like Skip. Skip was fearless. Skip said fuck every other word. When Skip was eating at the palace, the girls couldn't keep their eyes off him. He was the kind of babe magnet Ronnie could only be in his dampest dreams. But Skip also had something adrift inside him, something like a bit of bone which may, after years of harmless wandering, pierce the heart or clog the brain. He knew it, too. Even then, with high school still sticking all over him like afterbirth, even then when he still thought he'd somehow wind up teaching school and coaching baseball, he knew it. And I loved him. The look of him, the smile of him, the walk and talk of him. I loved him, and I would not leave him. So, I said to Billy, Tony, and Hugh, you guys want a lesson?
Nickel a point, Hugh said, laughing like a loon. Shit, he was a loon. Let's go. Wheel him and deal him.
Pretty soon, we were in the corner, all four of us smoking furiously and the cards flying. I remembered the desperate cramming I'd done over the holiday weekend, remembered my mother saying that boys who didn't work hard in school were dying these days. I remembered those things, but they seemed as distant as making love to Carol in my car while the platter sang Twilight Time. I looked up once and saw Stoke Jones in the doorway, leaning on his crutches and looking at us with his usual distant contempt. His black hair was thicker than ever, the corkscrews crazier over his ears and heavier against the collar of his sweatshirt. He sniffed steadily, his nose dripped and his eyes were running, but otherwise he didn't seem any sicker than before the break. Stoke, I said, how are you doing?
Oh, well, who knows, he said, better than you, maybe.
Come on in, Rip Rip, drag up a milking stool, Ronnie said, we'll teach you the game. You know nothing. I want to learn, Stoke said, and went thumping away. We listened to his receding crutches and a brief coughing fit. That crippled up queer loves me, Ronnie said. He just can't show it. I'll show you something if you don't deal some fucking cards, Skip said.
I'm very, very scared, Ronnie said in an Elmer Fudd voice, which only he found amusing.
He laid his head on Mark St. Pierre's arm to show how terrified he was. Mark lifted the arm, hard.
The fuck off me. This is a new shirt, Malenfant. I don't want your pimple pus all over it.
Before Ronnie's face lit with amusement and he cawed with laughter, I saw a moment of desperate hurt there. It left me unmoved. Ronnie's problems might be genuine, but they didn't make him any easier to like. To me, he was just a blowhard who could play cards. Come on, I said to Billy March, and hurry up and deal. I want to get some studying done later. But of course there was no studying done by any of us that night. Instead of burning out over the holiday, the fever was stronger and hotter than ever. I went down the hall around 10:15 to get a fresh pack of smokes and knew Nate was back while I was still 6 doors away. Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes was coming from the room Nick Prouty shared with Barry Margot, but from farther down I could hear Phil Oakes singing The Draft Dodger Rag. Nate was deep in his closet, hanging up his clothes. Not only was he the only person I knew in college who wore pajamas, he was the only one who ever used the hangers. The only thing I myself had hung up was my high school jacket.
Now I took it out and began to rummage in the pockets for my cigarettes.
Hey, Nate, how you doing? Get enough of that cranberry dressing to hold you?
He began, then saw what was on the back of my jacket and burst out laughing.
What? I asked. Is it that funny?
In a way, he said, and leaned deeper into his closet.
Look.
He reappeared with an old navy pea coat in his hands. He turned it around so I could see the back. On it, much neater than my freehand work, was the sparrow track. Nate had rendered his in bright silver duct tape. This time we both laughed. Ike and Mike, they think alike, I said.
Nonsense. Great minds run in the same channel.
Is that what it is?
Well, what I like to think, anyway.
Does this mean you've changed your mind about the war, Pete?
What mind? I asked.
Andy White and Ashley Rice never came back to college at all. Eight down now. For the rest of us, there was an obvious change for the worse in the 3 days before that winter's first storm. Obvious that was to anyone else. If you were inside the thing, burning with the fever, it all seemed just a step or two north of normal. Before Thanksgiving break, the card quartets in the lounge had a tendency to break up and reform during the school week. Sometimes they died out altogether for a while as kids went off to classes. Now the groups became almost static, the only changes occurring when someone staggered off to bed or table hopped to escape Ronnie's skills and constant abrasive chatter. This settling occurred because most of the third-floor players hadn't returned to continue furthering their educations. Barry, Nick, Mark, Harvey, and I don't know how many others had pretty much given up on the education part. They had returned in order to resume the quest for totally valueless match points. Many of the boys on Chamberlain 3 were in fact now majoring in hearts. Skip Kirk and I, sad to say, were among them. I made a couple of classes on Monday, then said fuck it and cut the rest. I cut everything on Tuesday, played hearts in my dreams on Tuesday night. In one fragment, I remember dropping the bitch and seeing that her face was Carol's. Then spent all day Wednesday playing it for real. Geology, sociology, history, all concepts without meaning. In Vietnam, a fleet of B-52s hit a Viet Cong staging area outside Dong Ha. They also managed to hit a company of U.S. Marines, killing 12 and wounding 40. Whoops, shit. And the forecast for Thursday was heavy snow, turning to rain and freezing rain in the afternoon. Very few of us took note of this. Certainly, I had no reason to think that storm would change the course of my life. I went to bed at midnight on Wednesday and slept heavily. If I had dreams of Hearts or Carol Gerber, I don't remember them. When I woke up at 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, it was snowing so heavily I could barely see the lights of Franklin Hall across the way. I showered, then padded down the hall to see if the game had started yet. There was one table going. Lenny Doria, Randy Eccles, Billy Marchant, and Skip. They looked pale and stubbly and tired, as if they had been there all night. Probably had been. I leaned in the doorway, watching the game. Outside in the snow, something quite a bit more interesting than cards was going on, but none of us knew it until later. Tom Huckabee lived in King, the other boys' dorm in our complex. Becca O'Bare lived in Franklin. They had become quite cozy in the last 3 or 4 weeks, and that included taking their meals together. They were coming back from breakfast on that snowy, late November morning when they saw something printed on the north side of Chamberlain Hall. That was the side which faced the rest of the campus, which faced East Annex in particular, where the big corporations held their job interviews. They walked closer, stepping off the path and into the new snow. By then about 4 inches had fallen.
"Look," Becca said, pointing down at the snow. There were queer tracks there, not footprints, but drag marks almost, and deep punched holes running in lines outside them.
Tom Huckabee said they reminded him of tracks made by a person wearing skis and wielding ski poles. Neither of them thought that someone using crutches might have made such tracks. Not then. They drew closer to the side of the dorm. The letters there were big and black, but by then the snow was so heavy that they had to get within 10 feet of the wall before they could read the words, which had been posted by someone with a can of spray paint, and in a state of total piss-off from the jagged look of the message. Again, neither of them considered that someone trying to spray-paint a message while at the same time maintaining his balance on a set of crutches might not be able to manage much in the way of neatness. The message read, "Fuck Johnson. Killer President. U.S. out of Vietnam now." It was flanked by a couple of peace signs. I've read that some criminals, perhaps a great many criminals, actually want to be caught. I think that was the case with Stoke Jones. Whatever he had come to the University of Maine looking for, he wasn't finding it. I believe he decided it was time to leave, and if he was going, he would make the grandest gesture a guy on crutches could manage before he did. Tom Huckabee told dozens of kids about what was spray-painted on our dorm. So did Becca O'Bear. One of the people she told was Franklin's second-floor proctor, a skinny, self-righteous girl named Marjorie Stuttenheimer. Marjorie became quite a figure on campus by 1969 as founder and president of Christians for College America. The CCA supported the war in Vietnam, and at their booth in the Memorial Union sold the little lapel flag pins which Richard Nixon made so popular. I was scheduled to work Thursday lunch at the Palace on the Plains, and while I might cut classes, it never crossed my mind to cut my job. I wasn't made that way. I gave my seat in the lounge to Tony DeLuca and started over to Holyoke at about 11 o'clock to do my dishly duty. I saw a fairly large group of students gathered in the snow, looking at something on the north side of my dorm. I walked over, read the message, and knew at once who'd put it there. On Bennett Road, a blue University of Maine sedan and one of the university's two police cars were drawn up by the path leading to Chamberlain's side door. Margie Stuttenheimer was there, part of a little group that consisted of four campus cops, the dean of men, and Charles Ebersole, the university's disciplinary officer. There were perhaps 50 people in the crowd when I joined it at the rear. In the 5 minutes I stood there rubbernecking, it swelled to 75. By the time I finished wipe-down shutdown at 1:15 and headed back to Chamberlain, there were probably 200 people gawping in little clusters. I suppose it's hard to believe now that any graffiti could have such a draw, especially on a shitty day like that one, but we are talking about a far different world, one where no magazine in America, except very occasionally Popular Photography, would show a nude so nude that the subject's pubic hair was on view, where no newspaper would dare so much as a whisper about any political figure's sex life. This was before Atlantis sank. This was long ago and far away, in a world where at least one comedian was jailed for uttering fuck in public, and another observed that on the Ed Sullivan Show you could prick your finger but not finger your prick. It was a world where some words were still shocking. Yes, we knew fuck. Of course we did. We said fuck all the time. Fuck you. Fuck your dog. Go take a flying fuck at a rolling donut. Fuck a duck. Hey, go fuck your sister. The rest of us did. But there, written in black letters 5 feet high, were the words, "Fuck Johnson. Fuck the President of the United States." And "Killer President." Someone had called the President of the United States of America a murderer. We couldn't believe it. When I came back from Holyoke, the other campus police car had arrived, and there were six campus cops, almost the whole damned force, I calculated, trying to put up a big rectangle of yellow canvas over the message. The crowd muttered, then started booing. The cops looked at them, annoyed. One shouted for them to break it up. Go on, they all had places to go. That might have been true, but apparently most of them liked it right there because the crowd didn't thin out much. The cop holding the far left end of the canvas drop cloth slipped in the snow and nearly fell. A few onlookers applauded. The cop who had slipped looked toward the sound with an expression of blackest hate momentarily congesting his face. And for me, that's when things really started to change, when the generations really started to gap. The cop who'd slipped turned away and began to struggle with the piece of canvas again. In the end, they settled for covering the first peace sign and the fuck of Fuck Johnson. And once the really bad word was hidden, the crowd did begin to break up. The snow was changing to sleet, and standing around had become uncomfortable. "Better not let the cops see the back of your jacket," Skip said, and I looked around. He was standing beside me in a hooded sweatshirt, his hands plunged deep into the pouch in front. His breath came out of his mouth in frozen plumes. His eyes never left the campus cops and the part of the message which still remained. "Johnson, killer president, out of Vietnam now. They'll think you did it. Or me." Smiling a little, Skip turned around. On the back of his sweatshirt, drawn in bright red ink, was another of those sparrow tracks. "Jesus," I said. "When did you do that?" "This morning," he said. "I saw Nate's." He shrugged. "It was just too cool not to copy." "They won't think it was us. Not for a minute." "No, I suppose not." The only question was why they weren't questioning Stoke already. Not that they'd have to ask many questions to get the truth out of him. But if Ebersol, the disciplinary officer, and Gerritsen, the dean of men, weren't talking to him, it was only because they hadn't yet talked to... "Where's Deary?" I asked. "Do you know?" The sleet was falling hard now, rattling through the trees and pinging every inch of exposed skin. "The young and heroic Mr. Dearborn is out sanding sidewalks and paths with a dozen or so of his rotsy buddies," Skip said. "We saw them from the lounge. They're driving around in a real army truck. Malenfant said their pricks are probably so hard they won't be able to sleep on their stomachs for a week. I thought that was pretty good for Ronnie." "When Deary comes back..." "Yeah, when he comes back." Skip shrugged as if to say all that was beyond our control. "Meanwhile, let's get out of this slop and play some cards. What do you say?" I wanted to say a lot of stuff about a lot of things, but then again I didn't. We went back inside, and by mid-afternoon the game was in full swing once more. There were 5 four-handed sub-games going on. The room was blue with smoke, and someone had dragged in a phonograph so we could listen to the Beatles and the Stones. Someone else produced a scratched-up Cameo 45 of 96 Tears, and that spun for at least an hour non-stop. Cry, cry, cry. The windows gave a good view on Bennett's Run and Bennett's Walk, and I kept looking out there, expecting to see David Dearborn and some of his khaki buddies staring at the north side of the dorm, perhaps discussing if they should go after Stoke Jones with their carbines or just chase him with their bayonets. Of course, they wouldn't do anything of the sort. They might chant, "Kill Kong, go U.S.," while drilling on the football field, but Stoke was a cripple. They would happily settle for seeing his commie-loving ass busted out of the University of Maine. I didn't want that to happen, but I didn't see any way it wouldn't. Stoke had had a sparrow track on the back of his coat since the beginning of school, long before the rest of us were hip to what it meant, and Deary knew it. Plus, Stoke would admit it. He'd deal with the dean and the disciplinary officer's questions the same way he dealt with his crutches, at a full-out plunge. And anyway, the whole thing began to seem distant, okay? The way classes did. The way Carol did, now that I understood she was really gone. The way the concept of being drafted and sent away to die in the jungle did. What seemed real and immediate was hunting out that bad bitch, or shooting the moon and hitting everyone else at your table with 26 points at a whack. What seemed real was hearts. But then something happened. Around 4 o'clock, the sleet changed to rain, and by 4:30, when it began to get dark, we could see that Bennett's Run was under 3 or 4 inches of water. Most of the walk looked like a canal. Below the water was a melting, slushy ice jello. The pace of the game slowed,
as we watched those unfortunates who were working the dish line cross from the dorms to the palace on the plains. Some of them, the wiser ones, cut across the slope of the hillside, making their way through the rapidly melting snow. The others came down the paths, slipping and sliding on their treacherous icy surfaces. A thick mist had begun to rise from the wet ground,